General MacArthur to go above the 38th parallel and to go up to the Chinese border. Well, guess what? That Chinese border was very vulnerable. That's where Japan had invaded China 20 years before. China, you know, had this Nazi occupation by the Japanese because of that border. So Mao Zedong says, reaches out to Washington through the Indian ambassador and says, hey, don't go above the 38th parallel. I'll be forced to enter the war. I don't want to fight America. I don't want a bigger war. It's not worth it in Korea. But you can't get up to the Chinese border and talk about dropping atomic bombs on us. I've got to respond. I'll be forced. Don't do this.
Somehow that makes you think of Ukraine right now, but it's a different book, maybe.
So Mao Zedong warns Washington. He reaches out to Truman. He had reached out to President Roosevelt. Now, this is the second president. Dean Acheson, Washington wise man, says, oh, Mao must be bluffing. Acheson knew nothing about Mao, China, Asia. This is the problem. Even today, you know, the Obama administration has no one at the top level of decision makers who can reach out to China based on any language experience or school experience. But anyway, so Korea is a tiny little war that becomes a big, big war because we don't understand China.
Well, and then there's Vietnam too. We don't kind of go into that very much, but we made the same mistakes there. Ho Chi Minh wanted to be friends with the U.S. and he was ignored.
Exactly. I mean, just a quick thing on Vietnam. What did 58,000 guys die for? How come the Washington wise men were so sure? It was the domino theory. The domino theory was not a theory about Vietnam. It was a theory about China, what China would do. Guess what? Secretary Robert McNamara, Secretary of Defense, who ran the war, at the end of his life, he said, geez, oops, the domino theory was never debated at the top level of American government. A theory about China, a China mirage, 58,000 dead in Vietnam.
Well, then Nixon went to China, and relations with China are they're very, very interesting, but it looks to me in some ways like Russia and China are getting together. They're going to have this sort of Eurasian economic sphere. And it was said at one time that this used to give Henry Kissinger nightmares or something. You think that'll happen?
You know, if we continue to be so boneheaded with our relations with China, yeah, anything can happen. You know, but back to Richard Nixon's outreach, that's how I was taught that Nixon and Kissinger were brilliant for reaching out to Mao. Geez, then I write this book and I realize Mao reached out to FDR, Truman, Eisenhower. When the JFK administration came in, Mao sent an emissary to talk to the United States State Department, said, let's be friends. They gave him 10 minutes. If they had given him an hour, maybe my brother wouldn't have almost died in Vietnam. So Nixon was just, you know, really slow to the game. Took 30 years for someone to stretch their hand out to Mao. Mao had his hand stretched out to the United States since 1945.
Well, it's very interesting because Nixon himself was sort of part of the whole China lobby sphere of influence or combine or whatever.
Huge China lobby money behind Richard Nixon.
Well, it's an amazing book. It sort of really it kind of sets a whole lot of things in perspective. And I want to thank you very much for being with us. We're talking with James Bradley, who is the author of The China Mirage. And this is a book that, it goes way back into history, but it tells us a lot about what is going on now in China and elsewhere, too, because same kind of wise guys are running foreign policy these days. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. My honor.
Hi, this is John Schuck, host of Religion for Life, with a warning. Progressive Christianity is dangerous and it will send you to hell. That's the message of clergy in Fountain Hills, Arizona. They've ganged up on Progressive Minister David Felton in a very public way. David talks about his response this week on Religion for Life. Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of One Flaming Arrow, an intertribal art, music, and film festival curated by RISE, Radical Indigenous Survivance and Empowerment. This event will take place from June 2nd through the 14th at Surplus Space and multiple venues within Portland, Oregon, indigenous lands of the Chinook tribe. One Flaming Arrow seeks to evolve the dialogue of indigenous survivance by introducing a biennial art, music, and film festival. The festival advocates native expression of autonomy through the warrior spirit. It stands to disrupt the hegemonic white noise of contemporary culture by focusing on non-conventional exhibition spaces and non-neo-traditional native artists. Spaces created for the radically political, experimental, and emerging. Surplus Space, located at 3726 Northeast 7th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. For more information, visit oneflamingarrow.com. Special thanks to PICA's Precipice Fund, Calligram Foundation, and the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts.
And good morning. This is Paul Rowland, pressed into service at the last minute here. We had a little glitch this morning, and Teresa wasn't able actually to come in this morning. So we had to find in something else to put in this slot that would have been Pear Fagerings, who was just aired. And what we're going to air is a talk that was I recorded last year at the Museum of the Oregon Territory, a really interesting talk about the history of Willamette Falls by former cultural manager and tribal historian David Lewis of the Grand Ronde Tribe.
So the falls is a pretty significant place for us. It may be the most significant place in the Willamette Valley for all the tribes here. It's hard to put a more significance or less significance on sacred sites because, you know, once you're sacred, I mean, where else are you going to go? But because of the combination of cultural use of the falls, as well as the long-term use by the tribes, we say since time immemorial, and of the last 160 years of industrial use here, it's really an amazing place. It's really, you know, it served as the fort for everybody to come to when they came to Oregon. It served as a place where they could get resources and find an allotment of land and then go off into the valley and form their farms. It also was, you know, for a while the head of government of Oregon, and it became the industrial center mainly because the falls were here. You had to offload your grains from the valley over the falls, and so they developed a whole industrial complex here that took advantage of the power from the falls through mill races to process all that stuff and then send it out to international markets around the world, to, you know, San Francisco, basically around the world. So it's a pretty significant place, you know, not just to the tribes, but to everybody. And for us, you know, it was, for the valley, it was the major stopping over place for all the tribes to come to when they want to trade, you know, products from the valleys or from the coast or from inland into this area. You know, there were other falls as well, but it was a pretty major place for this region, for the Multnomahs and Clackamas people that were alongside the falls. And so the Kalapuyas from the valley, they had a lot of camas and wapato, and they would process that, cook it, and then they would take that food in their canoes up, or basically down the Willamette River, I see. It's hard to say down, you're actually going north, but it's down the Willamette River to the falls, and they would trade with the Clackamas people at the falls, the people at Kanema, people, you know, on the other side of the river for the dried salmon. And, you know, and then they would take that salmon back to their villages and they would mix the salmon with other foods like berries or and they would create other kinds of foods out of that. And so so that's why it was so significant. Products from the north, you know, wealth items like, you know, dentalium that you find in necklaces, like in my necklace here, dentalium. There's some detail in the collection here. Really came down from Puget Sound, came overland sometimes. Sometimes came down by the ocean through on canoe routes that came around into the Little Columbia River. And those things come down to the falls and were traded into to the Kalapuyas and then even further south from that area. And so we ended up with a pretty amazing trade network. They all came through here. One of the things to mention about that is a lot of the tribes in the area couldn't talk with each other. They had different kinds of languages. And so all the Chinooks, they could pretty much speak together in the Kiksh language. The Kalapuyas in their Penutian language could all sort of speak together. But the Kalapuyas in their traditional language couldn't speak with the Chinooks because they were not the same language at all. They're not even dialects of each other. So so all the tribes in the area had to develop a way of communicating. They originally called it Chinook jargon when settlement was here. We call it Chinook Wawa. It basically means talking Chinook. And so that is what became a medium of exchange between all the tribes in the area. That was a language that was easily picked up in about a month or so of speaking it, and tribes could then communicate pretty well with each other all over the place. And so it was a pretty widespread by the time the whale oil trade and the fur trade happened in the area. In fact, it helped fur traders because they could pick up the language very quickly. They all spoke it, and so really, it's a language for everybody because really it was the most widely spoken language in the whole area, in Portland, in Seattle, in Oregon City. Everybody knew how to speak at least, if not all, of Chinook, a good portion of it, so they could be communicative with other people. And so it may, we haven't really done the studies or really have put the research into it yet, but I'm kind of thinking that it was the most widely spoken language in the Pacific Northwest at the time. And it kind of, you can see that if you look into older books, older publications, even magazines and journals, where people have written Chinook into their writings. And so you see them writing in English or French or whatever, and then they would write Chinookan phrases too, Chinook jargon, they call it, phrases into the script too. So it was pretty widespread, pretty amazing. We have been involved in efforts in Portland to name the bridge, and so we've proposed the name of Tilikum Crossing to be that. And we think that that's a Chinookwawa phrase that means people. It's supposed to be a people's bridge. So we believe that that's an appropriate word for that place. We have a problem. I personally, and the tribe generally, has a problem with the word Wai East because we really don't know where the word comes from. We've done some research into Wai East and kind of figured out that it was almost invented by Frederick Balk when he wrote his Bridge of the Gods book. And he seemed to have been talking with some Indian people, learned a few things about their culture, and perhaps put that word together out of a conversation we have with somebody. But we really can't find the origin of that word in any of the languages. In fact, we've had 3 or 4 linguists throughout the area that are specialists in the language looking at that, and they really can't find the word in any languages. So we're a little concerned about that, the Wai East word. So that's my piece on that. So I wanted to open for some questions. I mean, I could go on and talk about, treaties and removal of the tribes and the termination and restoration of the Ground Tribe. Is there any votes about what I should talk about? I can go on for a while if you want me to. No, nobody cares. So, do you know about the treaties? So, Cheryl mentioned the treaties. So, you know that the Willamette Valley Treaty encompassed the whole of the Willamette Valley, including all the Chinookan area here, all the way to Cascade Locks, all the way down to Oak Point, and then all the way down into southern Oregon. The whole Willamette Valley. And it included a good portion of the Cascades, a good portion of the Coast Range, too. So all those tribes, something like 19 Kalapuya tribes, as well as the Malalas, as well as the Clackamas and Multnomahs from here, and the Cascades, and even the Skilut upriver, they're all part of that treaty. And so all that land was ceded to the U.S. government in exchange for a permanent land base forever, the Grand Ronde Indian Reservation, forever. And some money, some articles of clothing, blankets, all that stuff. Social services, that kind of stuff. So the tribes made that agreement. They signed it. It was ratified by Congress. in 1856, the tribes removed to Grand Ronde and began to form a community there. It took about, 5-10 years, but people began to have children together, and so nowadays most of us have 5 or more tribal ancestries of the tribe. I have at least 5, Chinookan, Saniam Kalapuya, Yonkala Kalapuya, Tekelma, another. I know Cheryl has lots of ancestry. We all have multiple ancestors, mainly because of everybody being kind of kept on the reservation for about 100 years and having children together and having multiple, genealogical connections. Yeah.
How many people were displaced?
So the treaty displaced, that one treaty alone, probably around 500-600 people. Most of the tribes at that time in the 1850s had already been heavily, many of them had died by diseases that had come through. And so by 1850, probably 90% of the people were dead because there was no natural immunity to influenza, measles, smallpox, malaria, things like that. And so what was left were, at that time, we've kind of figured out that when there had been several different villages for a tribe, like say the Clackamas had several different villages up the Clackamas River and all the way up to the Columbia and down hit the falls, when so many people died, they had to collapse down to maybe 1 or 2 villages of maybe a few hundred people. And then even after that, there were lots of other deaths from interactions with settlers, the newcomers, that at times didn't like Indians. You've heard that before. And then continued death by disease, because disease didn't really stop one epidemic. And so by the time that it came to remove the Chinooks to Grand Ronde in 1856, there were probably around 50 Chinookan peoples left altogether from this area, from the Multnomah, Clackamas area. So that's pretty much it. So for Kalapuyas, there were some Kalapuya tribes that had 6 people left. That was it, from death by disease, displacement by pioneers, and sometimes hunger, because when pioneers came in, they hunted out or even fished out the whole area. So they were displaced. Many people died from that, and so there would be like 6 people moved to the reservation. For the Saniams were a little better off. They had about 250 people, but then also the Saniams had numerous other villages from, let's say, as far south as Eugene all the way up to Salem, and those people collapsed down to maybe 1 or 2 villages. There was a major village at what's now Brownsville and one at Chemeketa. So and maybe one up in the Albany Sio area too. So it was pretty dramatic. The change was dramatic, and it caused this amazing change in culture, from traditional culture to people having to basically live off the goodwill at times of the pioneers in their area. And many tribal people became very good at farm work, at ranching, and many children were brought in that were sort of like orphaned on the plains by missionaries into the missionaries at Salem, other places, and were given other names, were taught different ways of being. But it was pretty dramatic. The change is really dramatic. Yes?
The act of pushing the falls in,
I don't believe so. There was a longhouse on the West Lynn side, or the Lynn City side at the time, up to about 1853, and there's a report in, I believe it's the Spectator, talking about that longhouse being burned by local peoples, probably not Indian peoples. They're burned by the whites that were setting up a settlement here at Oregon City and didn't really like Indians that much, so they burned it. So so there's a report in, I think, 2 papers on that burning. But after that, they were kind of living on people's farms. At one point, they were given a temporary reservation to live on because they had signed the treaty in 1855. And then for a year, they lived there. And then in 1856, because Joel Palmer decided to move all the tribes onto the reservation to save what was left of them from basically the whites in the South that were really trying to destroy them all, they then removed to Grand Ronde. But after that, we actually encountered what's called the Passbook. It's a book that allows Indian people to leave the reservation with a pass from the Indian agent. And we found that book at Oregon Historical Society just a couple years ago. And it's the original Passbook that was in the collections of the Sletz Indian Agency, Sletz Grand Ronde, Sletz slash Grand Ronde Indian Agency, that was at Sletz when we were all terminated. And so that they came to Oregon Historical Society, and what they did is they called the Confederate Tribes the Sletz Indian Reservation Collection. It's not. It's the agency collection from the federal government, because they had an office at Sletz. And so looking through that passbook, there are several hundred pages of logging people in and out of the reservations, and you can see where a man and his family, and it would list the people out and what tribe they were and where they were going, how long they were going to be gone, when they left, when they came back, so you had how long they were gone. And so you can actually follow in the passbook when people were going to certain locations where they had previously lived. Like the Chinookan people, the Clackamas, the Oregon City people, you could see them coming back to the falls in the right season to perhaps fish for salmon or lamprey. So we believe that continued well into the 20th century, that people kept on leaving the reservation, coming here and fishing, and then taking the fish back to the reservation. So we believe that. She was brought here by Lewis and Clark. Yeah, she came all the way. She spent the winter at Fort Clatsop, and then in 1806 went back down the river with them. I only know about Oregon, so once they get into Idaho, I'm like, my mind goes blank. Yes?
I had a weird question.
So, what else? So, treaties. So, you know, how many treaties were there? Here's a quiz. How many treaties? Seven, right? So, that included all of the interior valleys, the Umpqua Valley, the Roger Valley, even the Illinois Valley of Oregon, the Grand Ronde Valley, seven treaties over a period of at least 2 years, and all written by Joel Palmer and his deputies. And that was about, we figured out it's about 14 million acres. So the tribes had those treaties, that land by Aboriginal right, because they had lived there for a long time, previous occupants, everybody knew it. So they worked with the Treaty Commission to figure out what their basic area was, they ceded 14 million acres to remove to, with the promise of a permanent reservation. So when they got to Grand Ronde, they got around a 60,000 acre reservation. Some accounts have it 69,000 acres, some say 61,000 acres. You know, we haven't figured out what's the true number, but we know it's over 60,000 acres. So it was fairly large in the Coast Range. Grand Ronde Agency was originally set up to be a temporary stopping point for those tribes that were supposed to be removed to the Great Coast Reservation. But in the year, they put a lot of effort into building up Grand Ronde, building up various farms in the area, and buying up all land from the donation land claimers. They decided to hold on to it because they'd already established, you know, a reservation there. The Indians were already settled. And so what they decided to do in 1857 is remove those tribes that were considered warlike to Sletz Valley, because Sletz Valley was a little more remote, and they could easily control the passes and keep them on the reservation at Sletz Agency. So that's what they decided to do. That's actually written in a letter by Palmer. Before he is let go by the Indian Service, he writes that letter with his plan to keep the peaceful Indians at Grand Ronde, the warlike Indians going to Sletz. So that's not my spin on history. even though sometimes we spin history. But so that, so you know that that the Coast Reservation wasn't really ready to go when they established it. So they established it in 1855, but there was really no roads there. There was like no establishments at all. There was no donation land claims. It was like an untractable wilderness. And nobody really wanted to live there except for perhaps on the coast later on. And so what they did is they created this 100-mile coastline where they were supposed to move all the Indians from Western Oregon too. But because it wasn't ready to go when there were a lot of conflicts in the south and some in the north, they decided to put people at Grand Ronde first. And then in 1857, they moved all the coastal tribes onto the Sluts Reservation, or what became the Coast Indian Reservation and Sluts Agency, and then some of the Rogue Rivers there as well. But let's get back to Willamette Falls. So we've been working a lot at the falls recently. We're doing fish studies there. We're trying to figure out how healthy the river is. You know, we're looking at doing lamprey studies there. It's actually the healthiest population of lamprey in the whole Columbia River Basin, which is why we believe that's attracting a lot of attention from a lot of different tribes. It's not only Grand Ronde that's interested in it. It's Warm Springs and Yakima and other tribes because it's the healthiest. You know, but we have a claim there because of our treaty. So the tribe really wants to be that long-term tribe that really works to restore the population here, because we're always going to be here. You know, the tribe's been here for over 14,000 years. The tribes have been here. Now we're confederated tribes. We're organized in our government. We plan to be here forever. And so we really want to be that sort of foundation for the restoration of the fish populations at the falls here. And I think that's a pretty amazing thing in today's society to hear, because, you know, state and federal agencies come and go, but the tribe is always going to be here. We're always going to be looking after the health of that area. We have our populations of people, the Clackamas and the Malomas, they lived here for over 10,000 years, or we say since time immemorial. So we're always going to be here. We're always going to be concerned with this area, concerned with the history, the culture, and the environmental health of the area. Yeah. Yeah, we've been having a lot of offers come to us and ask us to take part in various efforts for development of the site, and we're also involved in the Willamette Falls, you know, Heritage Coalition Board. You know, Cheryl and I are actually on the board there, and so we've been intimately involved for at least 7 years in what's going on with development of the area. And I think it's going a very good direction, because we're now one of the primary partners in most of the efforts going forward. We always want to be that primary partner, because, you know, previous to our involvement in the area, there were a lot of inconsistencies in terms of history and cultural, you know, and who should be here at the falls. A lot of inconsistencies. I mean, I'm actually not a historian. People say I'm a travel historian, so at the tribe I'm a historian, but I'm actually trained as an anthropologist. So, and actually anthropologists, you know, generally don't like historians, so I'm kind of going against myself. I'm kind of sitting on both fences. But in my job, I've kind of been reading through the histories and learning a lot about the history of the tribe, learning about histories that should have been written into the history books and never written in the history books by historians, and realizing that, you know, historians in Oregon have not been kind to us. Generally, what you find in these history books, you know, by Hines and Carey and all these people in the past, is they give us like a small chapter, maybe a chapter at the most. But generally, it's like a side, you know, a piece of the page in the margin, or maybe a paragraph or two. And they talk about, oh, there were tribes here, and then we're going to go on and talk about pioneers. And that's really what the story is of the tribes. And so what we're doing is saying, wait a minute, that's not really history. That's basically the history of one people. You know, you're getting about half or less than half of the history of this area, and you've had that for about 160 years.
Okay, we're going to have to just cut that off a little bit short. I'm going to try to get that up on the website for you to be able to listen to the entire event there at Willamette Falls last year with David Lewis, the former tribal historian and cultural liaison of the Grand Ron tribe speaking at the Museum of the American of the Oregon Territory in Oregon City last year. Now we're going to go on to Air Cascadia.
Kick me one of them funky ass beats.
Tune in Thursday, June 19th at 10 p.m. for a special live remote broadcast from What the Festival at the Wolf Run Ranch. We'll be showcasing the musical and visual artists at this year's festival with interviews, music, and interactions with the producers and participants, exploring what makes this such a uniquely immersive, entertaining, and intimate festival. Again, be sure to tune in at 10 p.m. Thursday, June 19th for our What the Festival broadcast here on KBOO Community Radio. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Thursday, June 4th, 2015, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. We are going to be speaking today with Barry Rosenberg. He is way up north on the border, checks his email once a week, living in a remote off the grid location, and he probably wants to keep it that way. Indeed, he and his neighbors don't want to see the timber companies blast their way through a pristine landscape. We don't see the pristine landscape, so we don't value it or treasure it. Now, come on, don't argue.